If you love the world of film and TV, then you've come to the right place. This is Reel to Reel, a podcast where film and conversation meet. Whether it's in front of the camera or behind the scenes, there's so much we can talk about. Grab your popcorn, dim the lights, and join us for this episode of Reel to Reel. Here is your host, Sergio Barrera.
Right, okay.
Sorry for the mess.
The mess?
Garbage.
All right.
Ah! Chacha Hamas.
Woo! Made it! Ha. I was so afraid I wasn't going to make this flight, so I sent David here to come and pick up my boarding pass. But now David has to go. Thank you. Bye.
I am Corbin Dallas.
Please report immediately.
And this is?
Lilu Dallas Multipass.
Yeah.
Multipass.
Lila, Multipass. She knows it's Multipass. Lilu Dallas, my wife. We're newlyweds. Just met.
Multipass.
You know how it is. Bump into each other. Sparks happen. Yeah, she knows it's a Multipass. Yeah, anyway, we're in love.
Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorb.
It's nice to see you again, Father. Where are the stones?
I don't know. And even if I did know, I wouldn't tell somebody like you.
What? What's wrong with me?
I try to save life. But you only seem to want to destroy it.
Oh, Father. You're so wrong. Let me explain.
Life, which you shall nobly serve, comes from destruction, disorder, and chaos. Now take this empty glass. Here it is, peaceful, serene, boring. But if it is destroyed, look at all these little things. So busy now. Notice how each one is useful. What a lovely ballet ensues, so full of form and color. Now, think about all those people that created them. Technicians, engineers, hundreds of people who will be able to feed their children tonight so those children can grow up big and strong and have little teeny-weeny children of their own and so on and so forth, thus adding to the great chain of life.
End of transmission.
Okay,
Ruby,
see you tomorrow at 5.
How was it?
Wow, was just absolutely
green.
Tough to the core, you know what I'm saying?
Green like what?
Oh, a crystal green,
any kind of green, like any green,
like green,
like
emerald green,
green, green. Coffee, sweetheart. What was that?
It was bad. It had nothing. No fire. No energy. No nothing.
You know I have a shoulder on you. You know.
And it must pop, pop, pop.
So tomorrow from 5 to 7, will you please act like you have more than a two-word vocabulary? It must be green, okay? Okay?
Can I talk to you for a second? Can I just talk to you for a second? I didn't come here to play Pumbaa on the radio. So tomorrow from 5 to 7, then you're gonna give yourself a hand. Green?
Something green.
Welcome everyone to this episode of Reel to Reel. I am Sergio Barrera, and as you can tell from the clips we've just been listening to, our topic today is The Fifth Element, one of the greatest films, in my opinion, that's ever been made, and one that gives us plenty to talk about. And we will be having that conversation with a very special guest, as I am joined this week, or at least on this episode, by Susan Chisholm. If you're in the roller derby world, you know her as Susan Bruiser. Susan, welcome to Reel. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thanks for inviting me to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, we got to start right off from the beginning by saying that it's not that you're just invited to be here. You're actually on every single episode of this show, because in the intro of the show, that's actually your voice that does the actual voiceover. So in a way, you get to be on every single episode I'll ever do of this show.
Well, hey, that's pretty awesome. I mean, who else can say that, right?
Right. Exactly. So thank you for that. I know I thanked you outside of this forum, but now that you're here, it's not just a great thing to have you on the show, but it's also an opportunity to say thank you once again for voicing the opening to Reel, and hopefully down the road I won't change my mind and have somebody else do it. I'm just kidding. So
thanks.
Yeah. So, you know, this whole show began as a project where I decided that from a podcasting standpoint, I just wanted to do a show where I got to talk about one of my favorite topics with whoever wanted to do so. And so people have been reaching out to me with movie-related topics, whether it be films, directors, genres of movies, things of that type. And from the beginning, when you and I spoke, you jumped right to The Fifth Element with no hesitation. And I'm excited to get this opportunity to talk about one of my favorite movies with you, because I think you'll agree, for a movie that is now almost 22 years old, it really does a great job of standing up to the test of time and remaining not only relevant, but also a fantastic example of just fun cinema. Think back to when you first encountered the movie. I'm not sure when you saw it first, but tell us a little about that. And talk a little bit about why it had such an impact on you that it's become a film that you are happy to talk about.
Well, when I first saw it, I think I was actually at my parents' house, and my dad is kind of a, you know, old school sci-fi guy. So, you know, he was down, you know, with Star Wars and Star Trek and everything kind of in that genre. And so when the movie starts, you know, we sat down together to watch it, and it was just everything struck with me. I mean, I was awestruck with just the actors that were, I mean, every actor was perfect, and the special effects, because at the time, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of fantastic special effects like what we've got now, but in its time, it was just amazing. And, you know, the way that everything kind of came together with the characters, the way that they interact with one another and the music, and just, it's absolutely my favorite movie in the whole, like, entirety universe of movies. I can quote it from beginning to end without having it playing in the background kind of thing. It's just, it's an amazing movie. With everything about it is amazing.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, while the clips were playing, you actually sent me a note saying that you were having a hard time not quoting along. I'm a big fan of, you know, of quote-alongs and so forth. Alamo Drafthouse, not a sponsor of the show, but I'll mention them. They do The Fifth Element at least once a year. And while it's not usually a quote-along, it is a movie that they like to feature as an event movie. And it makes sense because not only, as you said, is the story a fantastic story, but it's also got a wonderful cast, and it does a great job of drawing us in. It was released in 1997, which is unique in that movie, or that year, I should say, also saw the release of movies like Titanic, L.A. Confidential, Starship Troopers, Boogie Nights, and others. Another one of my favorites that I hope to talk about someday on the show, the very impactful and very serious, but not really, a movie called Con Air with John Cusack, was also released in 1997. But amidst all of these great movies, The Fifth Element comes out, and from the get-go, it does very well in the theaters. Luc Besson, the director, known for mostly, at that point, known for most of his French cinema works that he had done. Not just the director we know him to be today, but also started in France with a lot of French movies. And it wasn't until Leon the Professional in 1994 that he really received worldwide acclaim for his work. He follows it up 3 years later with The Fifth Element. And from there, it just sort of takes off for him. He does a lot of work that is considered different, avant-garde, and it really challenges people to sit down and you know, dedicate themselves to his movies, because they're very complex, they're very layered, and The Fifth Element, I think, was our first opportunity to see what his style truly is. I like to tell people when I talk about Luc Besson that you know when you're watching a Luc Besson movie. There are elements that are so common. I think of the movie The Messenger, the story of Joan of Arc, and you see so many similar jump cuts and the way in which he films and edits and so forth. And so, yeah, it's one of those directors. He's one of those directors that really, his filmography is not one that people look at and say, you know, this is all recognizable stuff, but he obviously puts a lot of passion into his work. And I think, in my opinion, having seen most of his movies, The Fifth Element, I think, really stands out as his masterpiece. I'm not sure that we'll see anything like it, you know, from this point forward. That's not a knock. It's just, it's hard to duplicate this kind of film. What was it about the story or the energy of the movie that, in your opinion, makes it timeless and you know, we can still enjoy it today, 20 some odd years later?
Well, I think, I mean, definitely, you know, the main message is in the movie, you know, like the quote that sticks with you is, you know, what's the point of saving love when all you, you know, what's the point? I'm of course messing up the quote now, but you know, what's the point of saving life if all you do is destroy it or, you know, use it to destroy. So, you know, there are themes that are just kind of, they'll never not be important, you know, with, you know, that especially, you know, it's kind of going over with, you know, what we see with, you know, war and all the destruction and everything like that. So, you know, what's the point of saving life if all you do is destroy? So that definitely, I mean, it's nonstop. It's never ending. That's something that, you know, with humanity, it's going to be a thing that goes on forever. So it makes kind of valid.
Absolutely. And that's the thing is its themes continue to resonate even today. Because when you take a theme like love, and make that the overarching, element of a movie, it really is, it opens up a lot of possibilities in how to push that message forward in a unique way. And I think that in The Fifth Element, Luc Besson does a great job of doing that. Let's talk first, before we talk story, let's talk about the cast. As you said, very memorable cast, very talented cast. And, you know, I mean, it just by naming the names, Bruce Willis, Mila Jovovich, Gary Oldman, who is an absolute hero of mine, with a wonderful turn as Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg, Ian Holm, Chris Tucker, Luke Perry has a scene in the beginning of the film, Tiny Lister, President Lindbergh. Just it's this sort of tour de force cast that brings its own elements. And when you consider, I remember when I first saw this film, and I'll be the first to admit that I didn't see it in the theaters. It's funny because recent episodes that we're doing here of the show, as we're talking about different movies, I find that I tend to have around the mid to late 90s, a lot of those movies I saw much later. And so I sort of discovered them after the fact. And The Fifth Element was one of those. And that's one of the reasons I remember having to go to, the theater for like a special screening before I ever saw it for the first time on the big screen. It didn't really catch my attention back in 97. And so as a result, I didn't see it till much later. The cast to me really speaks to sort of the frenetic nature of the movie. You have so many different types of actors, here. And I think that therein lies its uniqueness right from the beginning. If I see a cast picture of this film, in my head, I'm like, Gary Oldman, contrast it with Bruce Willis, contrast it with Chris Tucker. If we start there, this cast really, really took this opportunity to, I guess, in a way, flex what they're used to, but also take on challenges of a different sort. Let's start with Bruce Willis. Cool. Bruce Willis, action film star, to this point, I never considered him to be that much of a dramatic actor until I saw him in The Sixth Sense, but he gets to do a little bit of everything in this movie, in terms of what we're used to seeing him, do.
Yeah, he's definitely, I mean, at the time he was still coming off of, I think, all the, you know, the Die Hard set and, with everything that goes with it, you know, he's like the manly man, the hero of the day, no matter, you know, what's going on, he's there to save the day. But but in even in The Fifth Element, he kind of has that tough guy, but he's also got a sensitive side too that you end up seeing towards the end of the movie. So
yeah.
I like that for sure.
Absolutely. Gary Oldman as the villainous Zorg. You know, Gary Oldman is very much, it's very documented that he's a method actor. He gets into his role and lives that role from beginning to end of production. And with Zorg, we see yet another iconic character that he creates. I mean, we saw him later in the Harry Potter series. We've seen him in other roles that he really, you know, to use the phrase, choose the scenery. He's not one that steals the show, so to speak, because I think he knows how to balance his talent with you know, the overall production. But with Zorg, he goes over the top and produces one of the most iconic villains that I think we've ever seen. How familiar are you with his work, and what is it about Gary Oldman that stands out to you?
I can definitely say that I've seen a lot of his movies. He's one of the top, at least top three actors in my books.
Oh, sure.
I mean, just with everything he does, like you said, he gets into it, and every role that he's been in, it's just spot on every time. He hits the mark 100% of the time. And so, you know, if you see a movie in the cast, Gary Oldman is listed, you know that he's going to be just fantastic in it no matter what. I think as Zorg, just the eccentricness, he embraced that, and he's not, you know, evil in the sense of, you know, wearing, you know, dark clouds above him, you know, but he's got the quiet sort of scary evil, but he's also a little bit crazy, and
yeah.
He hits the mark every time again. And, you know, with this movie, there's definitely no gaps in anything. If I had tried to picture anyone else doing that, or even coming close to being as perfect as that, I can't think of a single person.
Yeah, no, I agree. And when you contrast his, and this is what I think is so unique about this film, is that every role is unique and so very well paired. When you have Ian Holm as Vito Cornelius, you know, his sort of malevolent approach to, you know, he's a man of the cloth. And when he's in scenes with Gary Oldman, you know, you have that sort of dark versus light thing going on right on screen. And the way the two characters mesh is so fantastic. Then you have interactions between Bruce Willis and Chris Tucker as Ruby Rod. This whole film is a contrast, light versus dark, you know, frenetic character compared to a more, you know, in Ruby Rod, paired with the, you know, business-like approach of Bruce Willis, because he's so, you know, the clip we heard earlier, when they first encounter one another, you see this sort of, not sort of, you see this definitive difference in character. And that's what I think is very evident throughout this whole movie. There's these contrasts that really make it fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, with Ruby Rod and Corbin Dallas, he's very, you know, methodical, military, because of his past as a military general. You know, he's very cut and dry, whereas it feels like with Ruby Rod, he's fluid. He can do anything, say anything. He's used to getting his way. And so I think that adds the dynamic between them. You know, him, Bruce Willis being like, this is how it's supposed to be. This is how it needs to be. But Ruby Rod's like, this is how I want it to be instead.
Yeah. Very chaotic approach, but of course made to, you know, plays well for the humor that's intended, in the film.
Yeah.
We get to Mila Jovovich, and I it's funny, cause as I was, you know, studying the information for this conversation there in the Wikipedia, description, because, you know, people can say whatever they want about Wikipedia. I love Wikipedia. her in the cast list, the entire character's name is listed, and I'm not even going to try. Yes, I am, because it might be fun. The entire name of the character is listed here, and it's Lilu Manai Lekatsariba Lantanal Chai Ekbat Disabat. And there's a great part in the film where Bruce Willis, or I should say Corbin Dallas, is just Lilu. It's almost like, that's all I got, Lilu. And we meet the fifth element early in the film, and that is one Mila Jovovich as Lilu. And what a character. We'll talk about her from a story standpoint, but right from the start, from the point in which she's regenerated in the chamber, I think the line in the movie that sums it up perfectly is when they say the fifth element is a woman. So iconic character once again created by this film. What was your impression from the get-go of Lilu, the character?
When we first see her and she's breaking out of the lab and everything, it's you can tell that it's she's going to be just a handful, no matter what's going on. And even later on in the movie, Corbin Dallas says to the Ian Holm character, he said, "When is Lilu not in trouble?" Because they're looking for her on the ship. And he's like, "Lilu's in trouble? Yeah. When is Lilu not in trouble?" So you could tell she's going to be a handful no matter what's going on. And you know, it's like, yeah, she's strong and she's badass and she's you know, running away and escaping and you know, and then she becomes fragile, and you know, after everything that happens with her, and you know, like in the bar scene when the father's talking to the bar bot, and he's like, "I know she's made to be strong, but she's also so fragile. You know what I mean?" And the bar bot's like, "No, I have no idea, because I'm a robot."
Do you want some more?
Yeah. So I mean, you can tell immediately that she embraced that. She's definitely going to be a handful.
Yeah, Mila Jovovich. Talk about preparing and really committing to a character. She, you know, one of the roles of her career that will forever be remembered because of how committed she was to creating this character and making it memorable. And mm-hmm. her work tends more towards the science fiction, you know, kind of stuff. If you think about all the work she does with the Resident Evil series and so forth. And in Lilu, she has, you know, take everything else away, and this is the kind of character that's going to keep you on the map pretty much for eternity, because this movie is so timeless. So props to her for the work done in that role.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, I know that you know, when you do your research and everything, and you've read through the language that they're speaking, the divine language that Lilu is speaking before she learns English, It's a completely made up language, made up by Luc Besson and her together, and they could have conversations back and forth with it on set. They could write letters with one another. I mean, that's some pretty hefty back work for somebody who's taking a role. Like that's incredible. I mean, I don't think that I could do that ever in my life.
Well, I don't think we can think of a position in which we'd be where we even would have to. So, you know,
there you go.
But it speaks to the history behind this film. This movie actually was about 20 some odd years in the making. Let me do the math. Because Luc Besson began writing the script for The Fifth Element at the age of 16. Dedicated his time as a child to, you know, writing and being creative. And it wasn't until he was 38 that the movie was actually released. So this was a passion project of his for quite a few years. And I don't pretend to know his mind, but we see how much of his imagination and his dedication to the story that through 22 years, he made sure that he owned the story, you know, owned all of the creative pieces of it, and brought this his imagination to life on screen. That's what really fascinates me about this film, is that it isn't something that was a script that somebody said, hey, check this out. This is something that, as a child, Luc Besson said, this is my story, and I'm going to put it on screen.
Yeah, and thinking back, like, when I read that, I was like, wow, you know, at 16, I mean, I've always been kind of, you know, crafty, and I've been kind of more on the arts side of things. At 16, I think that I was still doodling in notebooks and not listening to my teacher. I wasn't making a story, an entire universe, where,
yeah,
you know, and keeping these characters going for, I mean, even a week, let alone 22 years. That's just incredible.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. And I mean, at 16, I was bagging groceries, so you're doing much more than me. the point being that this is a, you know, we see so many filmmakers do wonderful work of all types, but when you can recognize a passion project, something mm-hmm. that meant something to a director or to an actor or whoever, it really does emanate from the screen, and we get such unique things from this film that we really don't get to see too often. You know, Luc Besson just recently in 2017 released Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. I'm not sure if you saw it, but I did. And in my head, I was expecting, especially from the trailer, that this was going to be very Fifth Element-esque in terms of not story, but in terms of visuals. And sure enough, you know, I haven't done a lot of reading on that film. And I know it's based on, I believe it's either a graphic novel or yeah, it's based on a comic series. But again, I never felt when watching that film that I got the heart that Fifth Element puts out with its content, its story, and of course, the way in which these characters interact. So
yeah.
I think we both agree, this, the fact that this has been was a lifelong commitment that Luc Besson had been, or, you know, a lifelong undertaking, it shows mm-hmm. very much in how the film plays out.
Yeah, it's his baby. He owns it 100%, and there's no doubt about it. I don't think that anyone else, I mean, if he had to try to hand it off to someone, there's no one that could have done it justice. I don't think, just because this is what he's been living for. He was 16. This is his. So yeah, and I know I didn't have the pleasure to see the Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, but it was on my list of things. I have a list of movies called What Do You Mean You Haven't Seen? .. So that one is on my list.
Let me know when you do, and we'll talk about that one as well, because it's interesting. Yeah. I won't say more than that.
Fantastic.
So as time went on, of course, Luc Besson works on various projects, and while he's doing other films, he's continuing to work on the script. And I love how I read a line as I was doing some research, and it said he was shortening the script for The Fifth Element and reducing its budget to $90 million. So, you know, he was trying to be, he was trying to be crafty and also, a good steward of money, but $90 million. And it ended up, I want to say the numbers were $263 million, was what it made on a $90 million budget. So not a bad return, as it tripled its budget almost, at the box office. It debuted at number one in the US, earning $17 million on its opening weekend, and, quickly, grew that amount, in the time that it was in theaters, one of the most successful films of his career. From a critical response, you either loved it or you hated it. And that's what I love about this movie, is people have varying opinions about the film you know, how good it is. I'm glad that you and I agree that it's one of the best out there. So as we continue our conversation, Susan, what I want to do is, of course, there's a ton of things I would want to talk about, but I also want to make sure we talk about any topics you have. Was there anything in particular that you wanted to make sure we discussed about this film because of its importance to you?
Before we go there, I was just going to say, everybody that I know so far has always told me that they love that movie. And if you come across someone that says they don't like The Fifth Element, I just want to say you don't need that kind of negativity in your life. So just move on. I'm teasing, of course. Something I really liked that really stuck with me through everything is just how beautiful everything was. In terms of costuming, in terms of scenery, everything had an element of beauty to it. So, and there were a lot of contrasting colors and, bright colors. So usually in if you go back and you think about like the space, the sci-fi and the space movies you've seen, everything's kind of drab and brown and cold. And in this movie, we've got, Corbin Dallas is wearing a bright freaking orange shirt, and Lilu's got her orange suspender. There's a lot of color, and it adds that, I think, richness to the movie too, that makes it not only appealing, just visually appealing in general. So I think that helps a lot.
As we, begin the story, it's, and we're not going to, summarize the whole thing. If you haven't seen it and you're listening in, shame on you, go see it. If you have, then we don't need to explain all what's happened, but it's going to be, we'll highlight items of the story. The general idea here is there's an evil that has made its presence known, and it is in the beginning of the film in one of the greatest scenes, in my opinion, where, they're trying to decide, should we attack this entity and defend ourselves? There is a line in which the president says, "I have a doubt," and the general says, "I don't," and there begins the trouble. As the evil entity, of course, shows its power, and the great evil, as it's described, we know that's the overarching villain of the film, and the problem that needs to be solved with the use of the four element stones, and of course the fifth element as well, who is destroyed in the first part of the film, which, no, there's no better way to start a movie and a story than to destroy the one bit of hope that apparently was the thing that was going to save things. So it immediately draws us into the story, and you're in. I think of the image of the severed arm as being the only thing that's left of the fifth element. And from that point in, I remember I'm sucked into this story as they rebuilt and regenerated her. I'm like, yeah, this is going to be a story. This is going to be a ride.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It brings you, your stress levels through the roof, because all you can think about is, oh crap, we're doomed. So, they regenerated it and that's awesome. But then it doesn't, when Lilu regenerates, she doesn't behave the way that you would expect. And that throws it off too, because Father Cornelius, he's the one that needs to have the elements together. He's the one that needs the fifth element. And when Lilu wakes up, she bolts.
Yeah.
And, so you've got this sense of, we've lost what we need to survive, to defeat the evil, to survive. And then, yay, we're saved. We've got it back again. And then she bolts, and oh no, we're stuck. We're doomed again. So, that kind of, roller coaster is throughout the movie. But it's definitely really strong at the beginning to kind of draw you in and just keep you just zoomed in. No matter what's going on, whatever else is going on, you're hyper aware of the fact that you're almost doomed now. So yeah. We're trying to fight for survival. So yeah, that's.
Yeah. Well, from the point of escape, then we see her encounter with our hero of the film, Corbin Dallas, a very down and out, kind of just living, just day to day, trying to keep his head above water. There's a great scene that pretty much for me sums up sort of his plight when he's having lunch and he gets a piece of mail and the proprietor of I can't call it a lunch truck because it's floating. The lunch boat. Yes. You have mail. You should read it. And you know, Corbin Dallas is afraid it's going to be something bad. He's like, no, it's a good thing. You know, it's good luck. You're going to be great, or it's going to be great. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And so, sure enough, the proprietor opens the letter and says, "You've been fired." So,
yeah. In between, you know, when he gets the mail and he says, you know, he's talking about how he's had bad news all day. And Mr. Kim, the driver of the lunch boat, basically says, you know, "Grandfather say it never rain every day. This is good luck. I guarantee it." And so then when he, you know, of course we find out that he's fired, he's like, "Well, at least I won lunch."
Yeah.
And Mr. Kim's like, "Good philosophy. Find good and bad." You know, so it's like, you know, even
as he floats away,
you know, trying to be just positive, trying to find a silver lining anywhere. He's just trying to uplift, you know, Corbin as it's probably the worst day ever.
Yeah, exactly. So much happening on that day. And not only is he dealing with, you know, his job scenario and so many other things, but he has the browbeating mom that is a fantastic element in the story. He ends up in the position of having to help out with trying to recover the elements also making sure that the day is saved, so to speak. It's a lot to try to describe without going into too much detail. But what I love about Corbin Dallas's character is his ability to he meshes so well with all the various characters without really changing who he is. You know, we talked earlier about the contrast between him and Ruby Rod, way in which he deals with, you know, Father Cornelius. It's just this entire. His character is able to deal with any one of the characters he encounters without changing who he is. If I'm not mistaken, I want to say we never see him and Gary Oldman on screen. Corbin Dallas and Zorg never encounter one another.
You're absolutely right.
Completely. Yeah.
Nope, you're
and yet you still
right.
understand. Yeah. That the hero and the villain never meet. And yet they're working, you know, to stop one another.
Well, and what's really interesting about it is, and maybe I'm mistaken on this too, like not only do they never see each other, they never share screen time, they never, you know, see each other or meet each other or exchange words or anything, but they don't, or at least Corbin doesn't know that he's fighting against Zorg.
Sure.
Zorg knows that he's looking for Corbin Dallas, but like that, I mean, that could be anybody. So. You know, that definitely adds that kind of, I always kind of want to laugh at it like, haha, you don't know what you're up against. Because he really doesn't. He could have been up against the shadow, the bad guy, but he was, you know, up against Zorg. He still just shine, just outshone. It was amazing.
Yeah. If there's a way in which to sum up the importance of the relationship between Lilu and Corbin Dallas, it's really, for me, summed up in a very brief exchange. There, it's right after she's, she's discovered that we are destroyers. The human race. And the subsequent events of the movie play out. And there's an exchange in which Lilo says, "Everything you create, you use to destroy." And Corbin Dallas says, "Yeah, we call it human nature." Therein for me lies the sort of the dichotomy of you know, the fifth element, Lilo trying to understand what her role is and why it's even worth executing, and him saying, "Listen, it's who we are." He, and that to me sums up his character. Whether down and out or being a hero, Corbin Dallas is the kind of guy that's just going to take the day as it comes, but he's honest about the fact that this is who he is, this is who we are, and there's not, it's not deeper than that. We just are how we are, and yet, as long as love is present, then it's worth saving.
Yeah, absolutely. And something he's just very matter-of-fact about everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he does throw a little flair in there from time to time, but you know, he's just point blank more often than not, I think.
Yeah. If we were to draw people into this movie who've never seen it before, what are some of the key scenes or that you would go to that you would say, you know, are your favorites or are reasons that you would really want people to see this movie?
That's a tough one. So, I mean, definitely... Obviously, I mean, the most obvious is the, you know, the diva scene just with the cut back and forth between the diva singing and the fight scene. There's another one that I can think of. I can hear it, the music in my head, and it's just kind of very, like, you can tell that it's meant to be very light and silly. And I can't, of course, my brain went blank just now, and I'll think of it in a minute. But you know, seeing the diva and how everyone is just so entranced by, and the music is so wonderful, and it's really incredible.
Yeah. Before we move forward from that, let's talk about that, because that is the scene I wanted to make sure we discussed. So if it's okay, we'll do it now. Plava Laguna is the character, and it's such a stop moment in the film where, you know, it does what it's supposed to do, and that it introduces the character. It basically shows there's a bigger world. And there's a bigger, you know, there's other elements that are sort of vested in the fifth element being found and being protected and so forth and so on. It adds this air of mystery to the movie. But when you get to the stage performance of Plava Laguna, it's, I don't know how to describe it other than the movie has been going at a certain pace. And then you're left having to sit through this beautiful, that turns into a really funky kind of performance. You know, I can watch that scene over and over because I remember it sort of brings the film to a screeching halt, but you need that in order to break into what will then be the second half of the film, maybe even the last third, because not only does that scene end up, you know, with the death of Plava Laguna, and the discovery of the stones, it leads into one of the biggest action sequences of the entire film and probably the biggest, action sequence of the entire movie.
Yeah, exactly. It's just incredible how everything kind of, like you said, it stops everything and then it picks back up at 150 miles an hour. We just go. And you know, with the thing I think that's really incredible about that is that the opera singer that they had playing Plava Laguna did most of those notes. I mean, obviously there are some that are very clearly, synthesized, but for the most part, she did well on her own. And that is incredible to me because obviously I have no singing talent whatsoever, but you know, with someone who's a professional opera singer, even most of the other people that they were talking to, they're like, there's no way you can't do this. It's not real. We can't do this. You'd have to synthesize it too much. And they found, you know, this wonderful person who was able to do it in at least a lot of it and just nailed it. Amazing job.
Yeah. It creates one of the most iconic scenes, I would say, not just in this movie, but in film. Everyone recognizes that at least that it's from the fifth element. If you just see that scene, it's one that that people recognize as being from the film, and for me and for you as fans of this movie, I know that we we couldn't have had this conversation without talking about the Diva Dance, as it's titled, that occurs in the film. For myself, you know, it's funny because there are people who I know and I've spoken to regarding this film who, if I ask them least favorite character in the movie, some of them actually say Ruby Rod, because it's so, it, you know, you got to keep up with the character and he's just so over the top. But he creates elements, and moments, that are just, for me, I laugh every single time, when they are able to light the, or, you know, put the four elements and the fifth element together and it all plays out. And then David, you know, does his little cheer and Ruby Rod's like, "What's the matter with you?" You know, it's just that outburst moment that you don't or that you weren't ready for when you first saw it. It still makes me laugh. Every one of his moments, in that film, you know, really make me laugh. So his role as the sort of the comedy relief, is necessary in the story, but it doesn't get old.
No. Yeah. I was going to say that there are so many little moments of humor that are just small little, you know, little tidbits here and there that kind of peppered throughout the movie. They make it just kind of, it just completes the package. But yeah, Ruby Rod to me is just, he's hilarious. He's so ostentatious with his, you know, with his clothing, and very emotional and very, I mean, he's got the, you know, the fragile ego where he's got the, you know, he's got his yes men that follow him around and tell him everything is great. But, you know, he's hilarious because he always says something that you're just kind of like, wait, what did you just say? Why did you just say that? So, you know, he's hilarious, I think. And I don't think that, I mean, if you're paying really close attention, I don't think that Ruby Rod is as helpless as everybody thinks he is.
Yeah. It's a fantastic character. Very memorable, like I said, as most of these characters are. And Chris Tucker really, you know, as a comedian, he's always been successful, but to this point, it was this movie that really put him on the map and did a lot to show his range and his ability to bring his humor into cinema. I find it interesting that you talked about the little moments that happened throughout the film. One of my absolute favorites, and again, it's, I don't care how often I see this movie, and I see it often. I see it at least once a year, if not more. I'm amazed I didn't watch it in the lead up to this conversation. So I certainly will after. But there's a moment that always gets me, and it's such a quick moment, but it's Corbin Dallas's reaction when Father Cornelius knocks him out with the I don't think it's a trophy, I don't know what it is, but when he knocks him out to take the ticket, just watch Corbin Dallas's reaction. And it cracks me up every time, because it's not only the sound he makes, but the face, because the camera is right in his face when that moment happens and you see Father Cornelius come up behind him. I don't know why, but every single time I get to that point, it cracks me up because it's such a quick moment that just kills me. So this movie is, like you said, full of moments like that.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's the scene that is one of, well, okay, I have two that are my favorite comedic moments in the movie. And the first one kind of happens early on, where Corbin is about to leave for the day. And he, you know, because we're in this kind of, you know, crime ridden area, it's, he's expecting someone to be standing outside to mug him, essentially.
Yeah.
And you know, you're laughing, so I know you know what I'm talking about. He peeks, you know, he checks out the peephole and there's nothing there. And he opens the door and there's a guy there wearing a hat that looks exactly like the backside of the hallway, so that he was, you know, camouflaged. And he's like, "Give me the cash." And, you know, throughout the entire interaction, you just want to laugh because the guy is so, like, you know, tweaked out, or I guess, or whatever you want to say. That sounds terrible to say it like that, but you know, he's so, like, intent on what he's doing, and Corbin convinces him to turn the gun off, essentially. And then he takes his gun and puts it in this collection, which it's like, you can tell that this maybe has happened a time or two before. But just the guy is just, he is hilarious in just the way that he acts. And he's like, oh, so close. You know, that's one of my favorite, that's one of my favorite scenes. And I think the other one happens towards the end of the movie with between Ruby Rod and Father Cornelius, when they're in the hotel after Zorg has set his bomb on the wall, and they're still trying to find things. They're still trying to go through everything. And he notices it on the wall, or on the door rather. And Ruby Rod's like pointing at it. He's like, Father, is that, and they look at each other. And he goes, it's a, because he can't get the word out. And he's like, no, because if it was a bomb, all the alarms would go off because these hotels have bomb detectors. Right. And at that exact moment, of course, the bomb detectors go off. So, you know, it, those two are like some of my favorite, you know, comedic moments. And I, even in a day to day with, you know, people that I talk to, you know, my husband and I do it back and forth all the time where we see something and we're like, it's, and he's like, no, you know, like with whatever it is that we're talking about, but you know, it's something that sticks with you. So you've got to watch that scene over and over again. That one will never fail to make me laugh until I cry almost.
Absolutely. That's how we know we're fans of this film, is that it's the little detailed scenes that really stick with us. Here's a bit of trivia for you. The role is simply credited as Mugger, and the actor was Matthew Kasovitz, who is a French director. I looked him up because I had a feeling that this scene would come up, because we're both awesome and we love this film. He actually went on to, he did small roles like that, but went on to become a director, a producer, and created his own production company as well. And, you know, most of his work has been done in France, but he not only appeared in The Fifth Element, but was also in Steven Spielberg's film Munich in 2005, and is also part, or has been part, of the jury of the Cannes Film Festival. So I think it's Cannes, not Ken, but the point is that here's a guy that has a role that is so, it's brief, it's impactful, and, you know, unless you look him up, you don't really know what else he's done, but he's done a lot in the French film industry. And, you know, he directed Gothica. I'm not sure how many have seen that, but again, this movie produces so many different talents that we know about or maybe don't know about, and yet they're all tied back to this film that is so impactful this many years later. I also looked up in your kind of what the legacy of the film, and it was interesting to find that of all people, Gary Oldman was not really doesn't look back on that time fondly. The story is that Luc Besson had helped finance one of his films. And so he did this role as a favor. He took on the role of Zorg as a favor, which, you know, hey, if he wasn't too pleased about doing it, he sure did a hell of a job. But when asked about the film, he was quoted as saying, you know, if he was asked if he liked the film, and he was quoted as saying, oh, no, I can't bear it. And so it's interesting that that's his reaction. Although pretty much the rest of the cast, you know, look upon that experience favorably. And, you know, it's good because it's a film for the ages. Well, let me talk a little bit about the awards that it received, because it's kind of funny. At the Academy Awards, it was nominated for Best Sound Editing. It was nominated at the Cannes Film Festival in 1997 and won the Technical Grand Prize. It won a BAFTA for Best Special Visual Effects. And the César Awards, which are presented basically the French Oscars, it won for Best Cinematography, Best Director, and Best Production Design. But it also won or was nominated for, I should say, two Golden Raspberry Awards. Golden Raspberry Awards are given out. I know, I can tell by your laugh that you're familiar. For those who aren't, the Razzies are a parody award show, and they basically are honoring the worst of cinema within a particular year. And that year, nominees for Worst New Star, Chris Tucker, and Worst Supporting Actress, Mila Jovovich. Thankfully, they didn't win, but they were nominated for Razzies. So it covered all it sort of covered all corners of people's opinions, this movie.
Yeah, and I mean, and that kind of ties back to what we were talking about in the beginning, where it was like, you know, you either loved it or you hated it, or you were kind of indifferent about it, I guess. But, you know, it appeals on so many levels to things. But, you know, that just shows how kind of infamous it's become, you know, because I think those the Golden Raspberry Awards that they were nominated for, if I'm not mistaken, was the year after The Fifth Element was released. So it was kind of like, okay, you know, so yeah, well, there you go.
Exactly. It's one of those things that, as we, you know, if we had a panel of people talking about this movie, we would probably discover other details that, you know, would make this a 5-hour episode. But just the fact that two of us, you know, who love it, can talk and, you know, go into so much detail about it really speaks to the impact of the film, but also how awesome it is to be able to watch it over and over. If you could say, do you find yourself watching it often, or you know, is it a film that you go back to now and then?
Absolutely. My kids love it and are also able to quote it almost from beginning to end, because we've seen it that often. And actually, the most recent time, you mentioned kind of back in the beginning about the Alamo Drafthouse having special events. And the most recent time that I watched it, the time before that, I went to one of the special events, and it was incredible. The environment, the atmosphere, they had people in costumes. They had special drinks that came in a glass that had the four elements etched onto them. They gave you temporary tattoos. You know, that I found myself actually just a few days ago trying to find another viewing of it, because I have a friend that I know is also a big fan of this movie and would absolutely love that environment, and just to be involved, you know, be immersed in that environment with other like-minded people. It was purely by accident that I ended up going. There was a group of people with a roller derby team, and somebody posted, hey, my husband and I can't go. Does anybody want to buy my ticket? I jumped on that opportunity because it was an incredible experience. But I say that I can honestly say that I probably have watched this movie at least twice to three times a year.
Okay.
Just, you know, sometimes because you've got the TV going on in the background and it pops up on there. And of course I have to stop what I'm doing and watch it. And I own it on Blu-ray, and the kids, you know, sometimes when they get tired of watching whatever they're watching, they'll pull it out and turn it on. And it's, you know, because it's something that everybody enjoys, and I can watch it over and over again. And so, yeah, it's one of my it is my favorite movie of all time.
it definitely merits that. Okay, so here's my challenge. Ready? I didn't tell you we were going to do this, so now I'm about to put you on the spot. As someone who is such a fan of the film, I'm going to challenge you to tell me as quickly as possible three of your favorite lines from the movie, because I know there's many, but give me three favorite lines from the film.
Oh, gosh. My favorite one, of course, is another one that I like is when Lulu just falls into the cab and she says, please help. And she's trying to learn. At the end, when after David screams, Chris Tucker is like, what's the matter with you? What you screaming for? Every 5 minutes there's a bomb or something. I'm out of here. You know, kind of, oh, that was tough. I mean, those are just like the first thing that popped into my head. And of course, now that I'm thinking about it, I can come up with more. But
oh, yeah, we can think of all. Yeah, exactly. Mine begin right from the beginning. Aziz Light is one of my absolute favorite. I'll use that. You know, if I'm in class and we've turned the lights off for some reason, you know, every so often I'll be like, Aziz Light, and then I'll turn the lights on for my class. And not many people get it. And
that's
then,
you,
I am a meat popsicle is another one of my favorite, lines. And
yes,
of course the line that we often quote here at home, whenever we're having chicken good is our favorite here at home.
Yes. Yes. I absolutely love all those lines. Definitely.
Yeah.
And one that we say here a lot is, going back to the mugger scene, is at the very end when Corbin takes his gun, he's like, take it, I don't need it. And then, you know, that's a very
oh,
nice.
Oh, man. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I'm going to have to.
Yeah. This episode is going to drop a few days after we record, but I'm telling you right now, I'm more than likely going to watch this movie tonight when I get home from the other movie I'm going to go see, because movies is life. Susan, as we begin to wrap up this conversation, if you know, I love the film because it doesn't really require us to be profound or you know, dig too deep. It's a great story. It carries itself and sort of draws us in. But what would you say, in your opinion, is the legacy of this film? Why is it that after all this time, in your opinion, it still resonates and it's something that is enjoyable after so long?
I think it kind of goes back to the main message of, you know, this is human nature. This is how it's going to be. And it definitely speaks to how important love is in the world. And, you know, to try to find that beauty and that love, even when things are being destroyed around you. So there are some very beautiful things in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. For myself, I think that the reason that this movie, you know, continues to be important, continues to be entertaining, is because it was the vision of a guy who said, you know, from a child, or at least as a teen, he had this idea, he had these themes, and the reason that it resonates for me the way it does is because you can see, as I said earlier in the broadcast, that this is the result of someone's passion. Luc Besson is a filmmaker, has produced some iconic work. And when you know the history of this film and how much he put into it for how many years between the time that he dreamt up the idea and put it on the screen, you and I are both fans of people in any talent or in anything that they do. We're fans of people who we know their story. We know what it took to accomplish the things they've accomplished. And for Luc Besson, though you and I don't know him personally, we can know him and his imagination when we watch this film. And there's always that little part of me, that corner of my mind that while I enjoy the whole film as a whole, I look at it and I remember this began as the vision of a child, of a teenager who just let his imagination fly and didn't let it go until it was made and fulfilled. And so it's a wonderful film, and it's one that I recommend to anyone who hasn't seen it. If you've ever resisted the notion of watching The Fifth Element, you've got two folks here that you need to talk to, and we'll convince you very easily that it's time to watch this film.
Yes, definitely. I always find somebody to get in there with me.
Yeah. Well, since you're so close by, I'm going to go on the record and say that at some point we should figure out how we get to a screening of this film. That way we can quote along and annoy everybody around us as we like to do when we're in the same space. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's definitely look for that. I'm down.
Absolutely. All right. Well, so every time we talk about a movie in particular, Susan, I like to make sure that we review it. Here on Reel to Reel, we do the five taco system. A movie can be rated with a maximum of five tacos. And if you've really got to go beyond that, you can put a little bit of guac on it. If you had to rate the film and looking at it, not just as, you know, from its content standpoint, but just sort of its overall history, how would you rate this film? And tell me a little bit about why.
Oh, absolutely. Five tacos and extra guac on top and on the side, too. It appeals to everything that I want in a movie. It's got a great cast. It's got a great story. It's visually appealing. It's got great music. It's just everything about it. I honestly can't say anything that I don't like about it.
Fantastic. Yeah. You know, it's one of those movies that it's almost unfair for me to ask people I have on the show to talk about their favorite movie. I don't think they're ever going to go, well, it's a three. And so,
yeah, no, definitely not.
Yeah. You know, as we get further out on the show, maybe, you know, not maybe, but my plan is to have panels, but you know, I love this notion of just talking about movies with friends on a show, because I'm going to agree. And by the time people listen to this episode, they're going to think he just agrees with everybody. Because I would also say five with guac because it stands the test of time. It's timeless. It has great themes. It has great action. It has, you know, just some really memorable scenes that, you know, people who are fans of this movie can encounter one another. And if you say a line and you don't know they're a fan, they can respond. And you find yet another person who's a fan of this film. And so it's one that I definitely recommend people see if they haven't already. And so if you're listening and you haven't, check out The Fifth Element. I don't know how else we can convince you, because I think we've made it very clear what a great film this is. Susan, it's been fantastic having this conversation with you. Again, thank you for not only being with me today, but for lending your voice to our opening here at Reel to Reel. You are definitely a friend of the show, and I appreciate you being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on and talking to me about my favorite movie in the whole world.
Absolutely. Well, it's like we always say here, guys, make sure you get out there, watch movies. They can really create community and a great feeling of camaraderie. So whatever it is you like to watch, keep doing so, and then join me here on Reel to Reel to talk about it. We'll see you next time on Reel to Reel.